to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today started going to Lassen Volcanic National Park when he was a child on camping and fishing trips with his father. Alan Willendrup graduated from Chico State in 1968 and received a Master of Arts from Chico State in 1976. He taught high school history and journalism for 33 years, most of them in Colusa, California. Besides his love of writing, he has a passion for opera and served 4 years on the board of directors for the Sacramento Opera Company. He also loves vintage cars and is a proud owner of a 1967 Austin Healey 3000. In the 1970s, Alan Willendrup wrote a thesis which he recently revised extensively and added many photographs, many never published before. The Lassen Peak Eruptions and Their Lingering Legacy concentrates on human interest stories, the accounts of eyewitnesses and survivors of the eruptions. These men and women are all gone now, but their spirits and memories live on in the pages of this book. Alan Willendrup, welcome.
Hi, Nancy. It's an honor to be here.
Well, first of all, maybe people need a reminder of where Lassen Peak is so we'll know what towns would be affected by eruptions.
Sure. In relation to Chico, I think Lassen would be about an hour to the northwest, maybe an hour and a half. There are several ways to get there, but best way probably is you go up I-5, and most people go to Redding, and they turn east, and they head over to Highway 44, and then it links over to, I think, Highway 36, which is the west entrance to the park. And then I think you can also go up the back entrance to Mineral by going up Highway 32, which is probably where most people from Chico would enter the park.
Well, when we think about the history of that area, how much do we know about it?
Well, surprisingly, a lot of people don't know about it. When I would sometimes tell people about it, they would say, "Well, what did you actually write this about?" And I'd say, "It's the Mount Lassen eruptions," and they'd look at me blankly, and then I'd have to tell them where Mount Lassen is. And also, a lot of people kind of know Lassen, but they don't realize that it actually is the southernmost of the Cascade Peaks. A lot of people still lump it in with the Sierra Nevada mountains, so that sometimes comes as a surprise to people.
Mm-hmm. So if people don't even know its recent history, how far back could you go with the history of Lassen Peak? We know Indians lived in this area. Could you go back farther than that?
Well, you certainly could. You could go back to prehistoric times. But one of my chapters, actually chapter two, kind of deals with the background. And it talks about when the Native Americans first arrived. And it focuses on the tribes that were in the area. And then there was a pretty good section about the coming of the first white settlers. And how Lassen got its name. Of course, it's named after Peter Lassen.
Who was Peter Lassen?
Peter Lassen was a Danish immigrant who settled in the area. The irony is that he never even climbed Lassen Peak. But he was kind of associated with a lot of things in the area. He was a would-be guide. Actually, he was a terrible guide. He tried to... He tried to get people to kind of take his version of the Oregon Trail into California, mainly because he wanted them to stop off at his
ranch
en route to the gold fields. And he guided a couple of tours or a couple of groups, and they meandered around. In one episode, they had to be rescued. And
because he got lost?
Because he got lost. So he wasn't much of a guide, but... He certainly is associated with a lot of landmarks, and in fact, there's a whole bunch of landmarks throughout the Lassen region. Lassen County, of course, comes to mind, and so that's how Peter Lassen got the name. Whether he deserved to have Lassen, whether Lassen deserved to be named after him or not, that's what happened.
So he both literally and figuratively misled people. I mean, he misled them saying, hey, come by this way because this is better than the way you think you want to go. And then he also couldn't find his way.
He may have had a lot of talents, but guiding wasn't one of them.
Well, you mentioned these eruptions that people look at you blankly when you talk about the eruptions at Lassen Peak. And when we see movies of volcanic eruptions, they're very dramatic, and surely people die. We think of the eruptions in Italy, Mount Vesuvius, and we see all these corpses. Did anybody die as a result of these eruptions at Mount Lassen?
Amazingly enough, in the year of its most intense eruptive activity, which was from the spring of 1914 through the spring of 1915, no one died. Which is really remarkable, because there were obviously a lot of curiosity seekers when they heard about it, particularly in 1914, who wanted to go up and see the peak. And so they talked to friends and they'd say, gee, let's go up and see a volcano, never occurring to them that a volcano erupts and sends out rocks and at alarming speed, which could, of course, kill people. And so in that sense, it was remarkable. There weren't any fatalities. There was one near miss, which is well documented in my book, and that's the story of Lance Graham, who did happen to be staring into the peak on June the 14th, 1914, I believe was the date, and happened to be peering into the crater when it erupted.
Well, now, you also include the volcanic history of other peaks besides this one here in California. And why did you think it helpful to include the history of, for example, Krakatoa?
I think it was just because of what you alluded to earlier in the talk, that there was a lot of stereotypical views about volcanoes. And a lot of people had these visions of these huge, massive volcanoes spewing lava, killing hundreds and thousands of people. And there certainly were a lot of those, I mean, some eruptions like that. Mount Krakatoa comes to mind. That was, of course, a major eruption. And so that would conjure up a lot of, catastrophic visions of what an eruption is actually like. But in most cases, there's pretty ample warning about when an eruption is going to occur. And usually people can find a way to escape. So I thought it was important that also it was the timing. At that time, there happened to be a lot of eruptions going on worldwide. And I just wanted to keep that in the context of people's visions of eruptions. And
because you have a lot of photographs in your book. And when I conjure up a picture of a volcano erupting, I've seen video of volcanoes in Hawaii, for example. And I think of lava, red, and flowing down the mountain. And that's kind of my image. And that was not at all what the photographs in your book show. So what did those eruptions look like? For example, the one in 1915. What do the photographs tell us about what it looks like?
See, there are four distinctive types of volcanoes, and actually, all four of them exist in Lassen, in the confines of the park. Mount Lassen is a plug-type volcano, and the lava that flows out of a plug volcano is sort of pasty. It's not the real viscous, fiery lava that you see in, for example, stratovolcanoes, which is characteristic of the Hawaiian volcanoes. So the lava that comes out of Lassen is pasty and thick, and it usually doesn't flow very far down the mountain. But plug volcanoes are still very potentially very deadly, because they have a lot of buildup, a lot of pressure builds up within the crater, and it seeks a vent. And when that pressure builds up to amazing proportions, then that's what causes a lot of the damage. It's these huge vapor-like gases that would descend down the slope of the mountain. And in Lassen's case, what happened was it did create that kind of a volcanic eruption. And the real big one in May 19th, 1915, what it did is it actually caused the plug-like or the really thick lava to come out of the volcano. And what it did is it melted the heavy snowpack, which happened to exist. It was one of the heaviest snowpacks that was ever recorded on the slopes of Lassen. And what it did, it caused all this snow to melt. and it caused sort of a chain reaction and this massive mudslide, which went down the northeastern slope of Lassen into the Hat Creek Valley below.
Yeah, because both of these eruptions occurred in the month of May, 1914 and 1915, both in the month of May.
Yes, the two large ones, the one that created the mudslide, which was May 19th, and then 3 days later, May 22nd, was the one called the Great Hot Blast. And that's the one that caused the vapor buildup, the steam buildup. And it was a spectacular eruption, could be seen all over the North Valley and even much further.
Yeah, I was surprised at how wide-ranging the different photographs were taken from quite a ways from
there. Pretty spectacular.
Well, I might remind people that my guest is Alan Willendrup, and his book is The Lassen Peak Eruptions and Their Lingering Legacy. And you wonder, though, they seem to catch people by surprise, and I wonder, weren't there any warnings before May of 1914 that there might be an eruption?
Well, again, you know, this is back in 1914, over 100 years ago, so there were, in fact, no seismographic, types of monitoring systems around then, there. And so, it did seemingly come without warning. But I have to say that the first eruptions that started were very minor. So it started with just, you know, steam emitting out, a few rocks maybe, smoke, small columns of smoke coming out. And it just gradually built up over the summer of 1914. So in that sense, there was a warning because it was just – and plug volcanoes are like that. They will just naturally build up and then reach a point. In recent evidence, of course, Mount St. Helens would be a prime example of that. It started out sort of in a minor way, and then it built up to a major eruption.
Well, in your book, you also quote this young man who wrote a letter to his mother, and this was 1864. And he's talking about this hike that he went on. He said, "It was a thrilling adventure. We walked over ice and snow that probably had lain there for centuries. We found a crater in active operation, sending up vast clouds of sulfurous steam and making a deafening roar similar to an immense steam engine blowing off steam."
Yeah, well, he was perhaps referring to the Bumpus Hill region, which is in the confines of the park. There's also some sulfur works, which are close to the current highway that goes actually through the park. But we are pretty certain there was no volcanic activity on Lassen Peak itself in the 19th century and perhaps not even in the 18th century. So sometimes, you know, those stories got exaggerated, like mm-hmm. the newspaper reporting later on when they talked about the Lassen eruptions. So they were probably referring to some of the steam sulfuric episodes that are within the current confines of the park, which you can still see today.
Well, what occurred to me, too, is the fact that we have no record of it doesn't mean that might it not have happened. It's just that we have no record of that. Well, one of the photographs, too, that I stared at in your book, there are so many interesting ones, but there's this lookout station, this fire lookout station.
Fire lookout station.
And it's just sitting up on rocks, and you wonder how in the world did they get that up there? This is spring mm-hmm. of 1912 now, so just shortly before, a couple of years before mm-hmm. the first major eruption. And they installed this fire lookout station up there. How did they do that?
Well, it was sort of the early type of a prefab. They actually brought it up in parts and sections. And again.
Carted up from,
I think, from Reading. I'm not sure where they actually originally
Actually, you said the winter in Red Bluff.
Red Bluff. Close. But anyway, so they just carted it up there in sections. And, it not trying to say that it was easy because there was no trail. Of course, now there's a great groomed trail that goes up to the peak. But, people had a pretty arduous ascent when they were trying to get to the peak. And it was a pretty remarkable. They were able to, get everything up there. And then they, of course, assembled it. And that became the fire lookout station, which had a early demise when the eruption started in 1914.
Well, it was rather amazing that it's just sitting up there on these rocks just by itself. And then, of course, people wonder, how did anybody stay sane if they had to sit up there in that fire station by themselves? Another thing I wonder, too, how they even got supplies. How did the person who was there have enough food? That's beyond the scope of your book, I'm sure, but I did wonder about that.
That's something I didn't research, but I'm sure they figured out a way to get the supplies to them.
Well, now, there was this U.S. Forest Service employee named W.H. Packard, and you say that he predicted an eruption. But when people, when he would say that, hey, guys, you know, this place is going to blow, and they said, well, yeah, you've been up there by yourself, and the air is thin.
Yeah,
so you can imagine how his friend said, yeah, sure.
He was hearing things. He was hearing the early rumblings. Of course, he was right there. He was on the peak.
When you say he was hearing things, we often think his imagination.
He was really
was
hearing things,
but he actually heard.
He was probably hearing the buildup, and it was starting to build up pressure internally, and it wasn't long after that that it, of course, started to erupt in the spring of 1914.
And I was surprised too. You say that we don't have a record of tremors near the peak, but the tremors were felt in Carson City, Nevada, and Reno. And that was before the first eruption in May of 1914. And that as far away as Carson City and Reno, they felt tremors.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then, again, it's just kind of a sign. I mean, there are signs when we have earthquakes. They don't always come without warning. And so usually, yeah, there is an upgrade in seismographic activity in a region. It can probably be felt, you know, considerably far away from its actual origin.
My guest is Alan Willendrup, and he has written a book, The Lassen Peak Eruptions and Their Lingering Legacy. And this started out as a thesis, and you were working on a degree. You taught journalism. Was it in relation to your interest in journalism? How did you select this as a topic?
Well, it actually really goes back probably to my childhood. When I was a young boy, my father, Edgar, who I incidentally dedicated the book to, would take me up on fishing trips to Lassen. And like clockwork, he would load up the old 51 Ford station wagon and put the creaky rowboat on top, and we would drive up old Highway 99. I was raised in the Bay Area in Vallejo. And we would drive up to the park and go to the Manzanita campground, and we were the only ones crazy enough to be there that time of the year. And anyway, to make a long story short, we started going up there. It was a ritual, and we would go out onto Manzanita Lake, and I would see that beautiful mountain. That's when it really started, and I was just so impressed with this massive mountain. Fast forward to college, and I was going to Chico State. I was a history major, journalism minor, and I was decided to get into the master's program. And that's when I said, well, why not try Lassen? Why not try to do a historical account? It oftentimes felt like a hysterical account, but that's when it started. And it just sort of grew out of that.
Well, thank goodness you didn't wait any later, because all these people are gone now. And you were able to actually interview some of the people who were eyewitnesses.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, Nancy, because the book would not be what it is if it had not been for the eyewitnesses. I was so fortunate to be able to interview. I really got into my intense research in the spring and summer of 1975. So doing your math, that was 60 years after the last major eruption. And amazingly enough, there were still 8 to 10 survivors who were remarkably lucid and remembered everything really well. And they were the ones that really brought the book to life. I call that the meat and the potatoes, if you will, of the book, the key eyewitness accounts that really brought everything to the forefront and told a great story.
Because if you had waited and didn't have the accounts of these eyewitnesses, you would have had to rely on what was written at the time. And it was quite laughed out loud at some of these reports in the newspapers of the time.
Yes.
Boy, they were wanted to sell newspapers. They didn't care if they were accurate. They wanted to sell newspapers. I thought it's interesting that the local papers tended to be more accurate than the papers in San Francisco and L.A. and New York, where they were more interested in selling papers than being accurate.
Exactly.
So, for example, this was in Hat Creek Valley. The residents in Hat Creek Valley were the newspapers gave the reactions of these residents in Hat Creek Valley. And, for example, there was a young girl, Gladys King. She was out on her ranch and doing her chores, and she and her father stopped for 20. In fact, I didn't realize that you might get nauseated from the experience, but apparently she did.
You could smell it. Yeah, you could smell the sulfur like.
Which were sickening for her. Yeah. But anyway, she and her dad watched it for 20 minutes, and then she went back to work.
She just went back to work. She had chores to do.
So that doesn't sound like an exciting newspaper article. So,
of course not.
So what did the newspapers pick up on?
Well, also, I think you have to keep it in historical context. This is 1915, not long after the yellow journalism era of the late 19th century, you know, the Hearst journalism of reporting the Spanish-American War. And I think there was still a lot of that sensational yellow journalistic type reporting still in vogue. And so I think there was a lot of pressure for the reporters who were from, you know, distant, larger periodicals to tell a good story. And if they got 2 or 3% of the facts straight, great. If
and who's going to complain?
Who's going to complain? It was good readership. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was particularly interested in the fact that I trust the New York Times to get things right. And you say...
Be careful who you trust.
You say, if there had been a prize given to the publication for the most inaccurate coverage of the Lassen Peak eruptions, the prestigious New York Times would have been hands down the winner. So why don't you give us an example of how the New York Times... You mentioned earlier there was a young man, Lance Graham, who got injured. He was injured. He didn't get killed, but I'll let you tell this. What did the New York Times say about this? How did they report this story?
Well, first of all, I should probably just give a brief little bit of background about who Lance Graham was. Lance Graham was the man that was almost killed. He was the one peering into the crater, and he was hit. He was hit by an ejecting rock out of the crater, which shattered his collarbone, and it rendered him semi-conscious. What happened, though, was he... other than that, I'm not trying to downplay the seriousness of his injury.
Oh, well, and his friends didn't do any favors either when they're hauling him down the mountain.
No.
Oh, that was terrible.
No, he was with a group. He was working at a sawmill in Viola. And so they, you know, there was a party of about five of them, and they were up there looking at it. And then, of course, it started erupting. And they did the prudent thing, which was to get the heck out of there. And but apparently what happened is that Lance was on his way down making his descent, and his hat blew off. So he ran back to get his hat, and that's when he was struck. And he was knocked down, knocked flat on his back. And then the other members of his party, of course, they're terror-stricken, obviously. They kind of try to drag him, which probably made his injuries even more serious.
I could imagine.
They probably dragged him about, 30, 40 yards down the slope. And then they just put him down, and he was unconscious at this point, no surprise. And so they just made the instant evaluation decision that if he wasn't dead, he was going to die soon. So they basically just left him there and, made their descent down the mountain. And that's probably where the confusion started, is that the first groups that got down there, the reporters that were down there, asked, well, what happened? And they talked about Lance's... untimely demise, and of course he hadn't died. And another party in the area found him, and by that time he'd regained some conscious, and he was able to actually stand up under his own power, and they were able to escort him down the mountain. But
he was able to ride the horse down. Right?
Yes, at the point he was able to mount a horse, and I think he eventually got some medical attention in Reading. at a hospital.
In fact, you have a photograph of him. He is has his the collar of his shirt pulled to the side a little bit, and you can see these very neat little stitches there on his shoulder where he was struck by a rock.
Yes.
And if the rock had been a few inches one direction or the other, he could have been hit in the head with that
rock. If it had hit him in the head with that force, he probably would have been the lone fatality on the mountain. So he was very fortunate man.
So this is the true story.
Yes.
And what did the New York Times do with that information?
Well, if I may look at my
book. Yeah, would you read from your book?
I will put on my glasses and talk about it. The ultimate in erroneous reporting about Lassen Peak's volcanic activity was the news coverage of Graham's brush with death. As mentioned earlier, the muddled accounts by Tipu and Phillips to the reporters at the base of Lassen had given the initial impression that Graham had been killed. Taking the word of these obviously distraught men at face value, reporters on the scene rushed off to phone in their scoops without bothering to check on the validity of the emotionally charged account they had just heard. One wonders why they did not at least wait until Graham's body had been brought down the mountain. The residents of the North Valley and Greater Bay Area opened their Monday morning newspapers to the sight of bold banner headlines about the June 14, 1914 eruption and its first fatality. Most of the local
first
news
fatality. Now they're first, reporting that it is a fatality.
Immediately they are reporting that it's a fatality, yes. Most of the local newspapers did not report Graham as dead, but rather as seriously wounded and not expected to live.
So the local newspapers had it right that he
exactly.
was close, but he didn't die.
The further away you got, the more distorted the accounts got. However, the farther the reports spread, just as I said, the more exaggerated and distorted they became. Across the continent, on the eastern seaboard, the accounts were grossly inaccurate, not to mention ridiculously absurd. If there had been a prize given to the publication for the most inaccurate coverage of the Lassen Peak eruptions, the prestigious New York Times would have been the hands-down winner. Not only did the New York Times err in reporting Graham's death, it committed an even more grievous blunder by supplying the graphic details of how the unfortunate young man had met his untimely demise. The front page lead story of the Monday morning, June 15, 1914 issue startled its readers with the following. The old volcano got its first victim today. Hugh Graham, not Lance, Hugh Graham, of Iola, was terribly mangled by a shower of rocks from the crater and was buried in cinders and ashes. Not only had the New York Times incorrectly reported Graham's death, but had also given the deceased a new first name. If local readers were eating their breakfast, they probably lost their appetites when they got to the part describing the gory circumstances of Graham's fatal injuries.
My guest is Alan Willendrup, and he's reading from his book, The Lassen Peak Eruptions and Their Lingering Legacy. We'll continue our conversation about the Lassen Peak eruptions after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, here with my guest, Alan Willendrup, author of The Lassen Peak Eruptions and Their Lingering Legacy. Now, you were, we talked about the fact that there wasn't much information or any clues, really. People didn't expect these eruptions to take place. However, and I found this very interesting, that there was a tribal meeting of some Native Americans there the week before The first eruption of May 30th, 1914. So a week before, there was a tribal meeting. And do you remember Old Chief Buckskin, what he said at that meeting?
Well, yeah, he had sort of a prophecy, I believe. He was just talking at the meeting, and he basically said that the mountain is really active. And I don't know his exact words. I'd have to remember
the
passage.
I have them here. Actually, yeah. What you write in your book is that he's supposed to have said, "All these little mountains around here are crying. Our mother is going to have some trouble. This is going to happen soon." And, of course, when he says our mother.
The mother is referring to Lassen.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he had, it was a prophecy, a feeling. And even though there probably wasn't really any seismatic, if that's the right word, evidence really to go along with his gut feeling. But it was a spiritual thing, and he... And quite a few of the Native Americans at the time really did believe him. In fact, I documented the one story of the Gladys O'Neill family that was took his message to heart. And on
because the, she was her heritage was I mean her name sounds European,
but she was Native American.
Yeah. So this Native American family, mm-hmm. Gladys O'Neill's family, you say in your book, they loaded up their buckboard and headed for Redding, and this is on May 30th, 1914.
Yep.
And then what happens when they get to Falls River Mills?
When they got to Falls River Mills on their way to Redding, they encounter some of the townspeople, and they start basically making fun of them and giving the patriarch of the family, Gladys's father, kind of a bad time. I instantly was able to interview Gladys. So I actually got this information firsthand from talking to her. And they were just saying, you know, I guess his nickname, I think was Mac. And they said, so, yeah, Mac, what's going on?
He says, his meaning her father.
Yeah, meaning her father. Says, well, the mountain's erupting and we're getting out of here. And then they were saying, well, what did you have today to drink, Mac?
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, they just kind of laughed at him as they continued on their way on their buckboard. And I'm not sure, half an hour later, an hour later, the mountains started rumbling. So one wonders if they were laughing at the O'Neill family then.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we saw who had the last laugh.
Exactly.
Because they believed Old Chief Buckskin.
They believed his prophecies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, who was brave enough to go up there after the eruption? Anybody?
Well, there was a ranger that went up, and he was... he had first heard about the reports, and I think it was Ranger Harvey. I'm sorry, I don't recall his name for sure, but anyway, he was able to go up, and he actually was able to get a lot of pretty accurate news down. He was over on the mineral side, and he was able to ascend to the crater, and he actually was probably the first person to really see the crater in active operation. Actually was able to get there close enough to see it as it was expanding through eruptions.
Well, I'm sure then everybody wants to know, well, why did this volcano erupt?
Well, that's the million-dollar question.
And I was amused at some of the theories.
Oh, yeah. They had all these theories. They had the geyser theories, which was somehow a buildup of water internally, and no one wanted to admit that it was a really active volcano in eruption. So there was the so-called geyser theory, which kept being expanded on. And so most North Valley readers, I mean, their initial response was, oh, it's no big deal. Finally, you know, it became obvious that this was much more than just a geyser. It was an eruption.
Well, I mentioned that you have a lot of photographs in your book, and on the cover, when I was first studying the cover, and I could see this is it started out as a photograph, but it's been colored, looks like, and a picture of the eruption, and then down in the lower left corner, there's this little copyright symbol, 1915, BFL. So I'm looking at BFL, and I'm thinking, well, Bureau of Land, or what is BFL? Am I supposed to know what BFL is? So I kept that kind of in the back of my mind, wondering, what is BFL? And then I learned that those are initials of
B.F. Loomis. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because the greatest pictorial history we have of the Lassen Peak eruption is thankfully due to the great talents of B.F. Loomis. He kind of lived in the area. He was an amateur photographer. And remember, this was in the time of, you know, using glass plates. You know, he had to set up this bokeh camera on a tripod.
You have a photograph of him and his tripod in one of
Right, right. And he assembled a remarkable amount of photos of Lassen in various stages of eruption. And I actually got a lot of my information out of his book, which was the Pictorial History of the Lassen Peak Eruptions, which until my book came out was really the one that usually most people read when they wanted to find out about Lassen. And it was remarkable in its pictorial background, a little bit short in a narrative. And so I would think that my book, along with Loomis's book, they would be an excellent companion piece for the park to sell, showing my story, which is more of the human interest angle.
Yeah, for example, you have an update that rock that hit Lance Graham on his shoulder. You have a photograph of the actual rock.
I do.
It's been preserved by his family.
And that's a remarkable story in itself, because one of the greatest things about this is when I was contacted to by, of course, Anchor, which is published in the book.
And you might say what Anchor stands for, because it sounds like a
social. You're putting me on the spot.
Well,
it
sounds like some
the association,
naval term.
The Association for Northern California Historical Research.
Yeah, so those are the letters for Association for Northern California Historical Research.
Exactly.
So they contacted you.
Out of the blue, they contacted me, because I had actually given up on any hopes of anyone really wanting to print this in a wide kind of a circulation. It had been printed before. It was actually Anchor's predecessor, which is the Northern California Record and Research Society. But they'd basically taken my thesis and just reprinted the thesis, you know, without illustrations.
That's the first time now.
The first time. That was in 1983. Mm-hmm. Without illustrations, without photography. And it got some attention, but quite frankly, I think it just languished and gathered dust on as a resource book at college libraries and at historical societies. It never got the circulation that I hoped it would.
So along comes the Association for Northern California Historical Research, and they say, Alan, we'd like to publish your book.
They did. And there's an interesting story behind that, if I may. I was talking about ironies. On the day they contacted me, I was traveling through Italy. And I had actually docked at Naples, and I was going on a shoreline excursion. My interest in volcanoes, I wanted to see Mount Vesuvius, which was nearby. And so, of course, Mount Vesuvius was the ancient volcano which rained havoc on Pompeii, buried it nearly 2,000 years ago. So the very day I was going on this shoreline excursion, I was checking email on my tablet, and there was the email from Anchor telling me they wanted to reprint my book. So how's that for irony or divine providence, karma?
Serendipity.
Yeah. I think I got off on a tangent. You were asking me about Lance Graham, right?
Well, yeah. But the family saved the family almost killed him.
So, yeah. So when we were doing the research, because it was obvious when Anchor contacted me, there was a lot of updating that had to be done, finding photographs, things like that. And so, you know, we started doing this research. I also have to mention Josie Smith. Josie is a member of Anchor, and she was instrumental in helping me. She went with me on a lot of these fact-finding missions. She designed the covers. She did the formatting, chose the photos. So I have to give credit to Josie. But anyway, on one of our missions, we had a link and found out that Lance Graham's grandson, Jim, still lived in Manton. And Manton is a mountain community close to Lassen. And so we called him. We arranged to go over and see him. And he said, well, I'd like my sister Charlotte to come because she's the family historian. Sure, bring her along. So anyway, we're there talking, reminiscing about about his grandfather. And then Charlotte excuses herself for a minute, comes back out, and what do you think she's holding? The rock, the very rock that hit her grandfather and shattered his collarbone. So that was a very moving experience, actually.
My guest is Alan Willendrup, and he has written a book, The Lassen Peak Eruptions and Their Lingering Legacy. And it was interesting, too. We talked about the fact that newspapers kind of exaggerated things. And then I understand somebody in Chicago was wondering, gosh, is Chico buried in Chico now? Is Chico buried in volcanic ash?
Yeah, yeah. I think a family member. I think a family member wrote a letter to someone in Chico, and we're so concerned. I said, "Are you buried in ash? Or are you going to survive?" Yeah, lots of that.
Well, now June 14th, 1915 was a memorable day. We mentioned the dates of the eruptions in May of 1914 and 1915, and then June 14th, 1915, you say in your book, was a memorable day.
Well, I think you're referring to June 14th, 1914. That's a mistake. That was the day that, of course, Lance Graham was of course, hit by the crater. So that made it a pretty memorable day, and it was probably the first time that eruptions had reached a point where it was really starting to gather a lot of interest. So that was sort of a landmark day, because from that point on, the reporting intensified, interest widened. So, June 14th was sort of a turning point.
I meant 1914.
Yeah, it wasn't 1915.
And you say it was a day of first. It was the first time the volcano experienced more than one eruption in a single day.
Right.
And then that's the remarkable Mr. Loomis mm-hmm. was photographing, mm-hmm. was this. Chapter four is when you start talking about what happened in 1915.
Yes.
Before that, so we had the first major eruption in 1914, and then were there any clues that the Lassen Peak might erupt again before the May of 1915?
No. But what happened was that the spring and summer of 1914 experienced all these eruptions, which were relatively minor, not in great intensity. And then in the fall, they kind of died down. And then, of course, with the advent of winter, snow started falling. And that was one of the big, really epic snowfalls in the region. And there wasn't any really visible signs of volcanic activity in the winter of 1915. So, yeah, it did come as somewhat of a shock when suddenly, without really seemingly much warning, it experienced the massive May 19th eruption, which produced the mudslide.
Yeah, now these mudslides could have done a lot of damage, but you say there are a couple of reasons that they didn't. And you said one was the season. And one was the fact that the terrain was irregular.
Well, they did a lot of damage in the sense that they damaged landscape and things like mm-hmm. that, and, you know, timber. And but as far as human life was concerned, again, it was a very fortunate time of the year, because it was a time when most people didn't live there. There were the hardy settlers, the farmers that had ranches that did live in the Hat Creek Valley. But it was not as bad as it would have been if, let's say, it had happened a couple months later. Mm-hmm. So that was a remarkably lucky set of circumstances.
So we have these mudslides, and one of the things I like about books like yours is that when we're in school, we study the history of George Washington and all the generals and presidents. But you have, and you probably don't, maybe you don't even remember this sentence in your book. You said, Mrs. Hall cooked fried bread and bacon for the hungry group until the water receded. Fried bread and bacon.
Yep. And, yes, that was a staple back then.
Yeah. Well, now, in this hungry group, and I'm maybe getting ahead of it, but the mudslides, and you have the stories of two men who survived potential tragedy on that May 19th of 1915. And you remember why you said they survived? Two reasons you gave.
Good
luck for
luck, obviously, really good luck. They were young men. They were fast on their feet. The two men you're referring to are Harvey Wilcox and Elmer Soran. Mm-hmm.
And you said they were clear thinking. They kept their heads.
They kept their heads. And I was very fortunate 60 years later to find one of the two men still alive, and that was Elmer Soran. And Elmer is the man that was probably credited with saving lives because he had a lean-to.
And yet he didn't get credit for it. The reports gave somebody else
exactly.
credit
He
for
never
it.
Got credit for it at first. I mean
yeah,
initially.
Then.
And when I was doing my research back in 1975, I kept coming across his name. And I would ask people, I would ask the locals, anyone know Elmer Soran? Is he still alive? Is he around? And most people said, oh, no, Elmer died. He died years ago. And a couple of people said, well, he's still alive, but he moved out of the area. We don't know where he went. And then I don't remember where I heard it, but someone said, oh, Elmer, just talked to him last week. He's in a trailer park in Grass Valley. Grass Valley, that's great. So
yeah,
I made a beeline.
A short drive away.
Yeah, and I contacted him first, and he was living in this trailer home. He was 86 years old at the time. He was nearly blind, but he had all of his faculties, and he was more than happy to tell me the story. And he really reconstructed the events and gave me a pretty accurate account of that harrowing night in which he actually—
And this is—that makes it even more harrowing, the fact that this is taking place at night.
Yes, it was at night. It was probably about 11 o'clock at night.
Because I don't think we realize how dark nights can be, because we are accustomed to city lights. I mean, even when it's nighttime, it's
right.
not that dark.
Right.
So I
pitch,
just
pitch black.
Yeah.
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 But he heard it. He heard the mudslide roaring down. So he knew something was amiss. And so he just ran. He was a young man. He was you know, agile. And he actually ran. He flipped over a barbed wire fence on his feet, and he ran over to the Witt Hall family. And probably
and
saved their
Mrs.
lives.
And that's Mrs. Hall that
Mrs.
cooked,
Hall
breakfast
that cooked the breakfast. And that, incidentally, their cabin was actually taken about 50 feet off its foundation by the mudslide. And the cabin still exists today. It's in remarkably good shape.
You have a couple of photographs
of that very cabin
in your book.
With yours truly posing in front of it. Eternal ham.
Well, I mentioned that they got the story wrong when they were given credit to a forest ranger named Fred Seaborn
yes.
instead of Elmer
yes.
Soran as being the angel of mercy, as you refer to him. And in the reports, Seaborn was aroused by a flood of water, when the reality was he was waked up by a phone call.
It was a phone call. It was a phone call. The Hall family had a phone, I believe. And so that's where the erroneous, confusing aspects of it started, because Fred Seaborn did receive the call and then, of course, was able to spread the word.
Well, and you also have some of the humor is the fact that there was a professor, T.J. C., who kept a perfect record of inaccurate prophecies about the eruptions. And then you refer to an eccentric professor, Albert Porta, who was a proponent of the sunspot theory.
Sunspot theory, yeah. He actually said that the eruptions were caused by sunspots, yeah.
So there's all this information floating around, and you say that the aftermath of what happened that late evening in May 19th, 1915, you say that nobody really knows exactly what happened. Because there was so much confusion.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Again, there was a lot of confusion, and it took several days to sort it out. And once again, the consistently inaccurate reporting continued. And again, it was like publications further away usually didn't have the facts straight.
But they didn't care.
They didn't care. Wanted to sell those newspapers.
In fact, they didn't even, when the New York Times is reporting young Lance Graham as deceased.
Yes.
And how did they even, they didn't exactly admit, well, we got it wrong. They
not
didn't
exactly
say they
retraction.
Got it wrong.
Not exactly
yeah.
retraction.
You remember what they said?
Oh, gosh. Well, they started, I think they said he was not deceased, but he was probably not going to survive.
Mm, yeah.
And they got his name wrong.
Yeah.
They were just, it was pretty terrible.
Well, the last chapter, chapter 5 in your book, is the lingering legacy.
Yes.
And what is the legacy?
Well, I think the legacy is just the ongoing interest in Lassen and the possibility, like any cascade peak, that it could potentially erupt. A lot of people, I think actually most people probably realize since St. Helens that cascade peaks are not extinct. And that was brought into, you know, sharp focus in 1980 when Mount St. Helens erupted. And so the legacy is that these are they're not active volcanoes. They're dormant. They're sleeping volcanoes. But there isn't anything that to say that they couldn't suddenly awake. And one of the things I talked about in that chapter is the frightening specter of what would happen in the most populated areas of the Northwest, meaning the Portland area, which is at the base of course, Mount Hood, and Seattle, Puget Sound area near Mount Rainier. If a catastrophic eruption like St. Helens occurred up there.
Yeah, because at the time, 100 years ago, this area was more sparsely populated, mm-hmm. and so there was less potential for loss of life. Whereas now, you just mentioned all these population areas.
Right, right. And two of those peaks happen to be in big population areas. So it is a cause for concern. But I suppose like residents of San Francisco that live constantly with the earthquake threat, I think probably residents of Seattle and Portland just shrug it off and say, what will be, will be.
There are other things to worry about
there
besides
that. In life, yes.
Well, you have done us a great service in putting all this together, Alan. And I know it was a labor of love for you.
Truly.
Because you're so passionate about
Truly
this subject.
It was. I thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Well, it's been a great delight. And not only am I a fan of your book, but there's somebody else who's a fan of your book. It was interesting. I looked back in the sources. One, you mentioned a friend of mine, Robert Speer, who wrote for the Chico News and Review. But among the sources, you have the Chico Enterprise, which is a newspaper at that time, and the Chico Record was a paper at the time. And the current book reviewer for the Chico Enterprise Record is Dan Barnett. And I've invited him to read a favorite selection of his from this book of yours. And it is Harvey Wilcox Cheat's death. You mentioned there were two survivors of that most recent, the 1915.
Right.
One was Elmer
Sorahan,
that you got to interview personally. And then Dan loved the account that Harvey Wilcox Cheat's death.
ANCHOR, the Association for Northern California Historical Research, headquartered at Chico State, has produced an exemplary book called The Lassen Peak Eruptions and Their Lingering Legacy by Alan Wayne Willendrup. What it does is draw on Willendrup's research, especially back in 1975 when he did some interviews with witnesses to the eruptions of Lassen Peak in 1914 and 1915. And one of the stories is called Harvey Wilcox Cheat's Death. And here's that story. May 19th, 1915. It'd been a particularly busy day for 48-year-old Harvey Wilcox. At long last, he was ready to move into the cabin he had just completed building on his homestead. He was putting the finishing touches on his new home, and some furnishings were still stacked in the corral area close by. Wilcox was going to move them in the very next day. That evening, he had been up later than usual, waiting for a freight shipment of more household furnishings. Shortly before 10 p.m., the tired homesteader had given up and retired to his lean-to for the night. Now, he's living in the Hat Creek area. This is at the base of Lassen Peak. It did not take him long to doze off, but it would not be a long sleep. Less than 1 hour later, Wilcox's peaceful slumber was rudely interrupted by the thundering hooves of the four horses in his corral. Two of them, a big black saddle horse and a pack mare, belonged to his neighbor, Sorahan, who did not have a fenced area to keep them. The other two horses owned by Wilcox were two old pensioners, nearly 30 years old. But at that moment, Wilcox was jolted out of his sleep. His old chargers were too terror-stricken to feel the rigors of old age. The four horses raced by his lean-to down to the nearby creek and then down towards the northern edge of the homestead. The startled Wilcox popped his head out into the cold mountain night to see what was spooking his horses. One look, and he was suddenly wide awake. A 20-foot wall of mud debris was roaring down the picturesque canyon Wilcox had so often admired, directly towards him and his flimsy lean-to. He did not hesitate. In one motion, Wilcox swooped up his overalls as he rushed by his bed towards the outer flap of his lean-to. Making a dash towards the higher ground on the west side of his homestead, Wilcox, in his panic-stricken condition, forgot there was a barbed wire fence in the way. Crashing into it, he fell down flat on his back. Rolling over on his stomach, he crawled under the wires of the fence to the other side. It was only then that Wilcox took a quick look back. What he saw was not encouraging. The onrushing flood engulfed and demolished his newly built home. He later recalled that the logs from his cabin were, quote, flying through the air like matchsticks, end quote. But the fate of his cabin was of secondary importance to Wilcox at that moment. The sudden impact with the barbed wire fence had jarred the badly frightened man back to his senses, realizing that his only chance to avoid being swept away by the rushing torrent was to get to higher ground. Wilcox continued to scramble up to safety. He crawled over a jagged lava bed, which was a difficult trek for a middle-aged man in the best of times, especially at night. Compounding Wilcox's woes was the condition of his feet. In the hasty departure, he had forgotten to take his boots. Consequently, his barefoot ascent over the sharp lava rock was all the more arduous. When the weary homesteader reached a point where he felt safe, he looked down towards his spread. He could see little in the blackness. It was just as well. Wilcox's cabin, the product of months of hard toil, had been reduced to splintered firewood and swept away. Now, the interesting thing about the stories relating to the eruptions of Lassen Peak was that local newspapers and newspapers from around the country made more of the eruptions than really they ought to have done. No one actually died directly from the eruptions at Lassen Peak. But you'd hardly know that because, for example, in the Redding Record Searchlight, the headline on May 22, 1915 was this: Mountain vomits lava and mud, hundreds fleeing for their lives. Well, sort of. It's a great story. And what the author wants to do is to dial down the hype in the newspapers and other media and to give some firsthand accounts of what really happened and what it was like to see a 20-foot wall of mud coming straight for you.
Dan Barnett writes the Sunday Bibliophile column for the Chico Enterprise Record. I would like to thank Dan for reading Harvey Wilcox Cheat's Death from the Lassen Peak Eruptions and Their Lingering Legacy by today's guest, Alan Willendrup. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.